I have been asked to record my experiences, my wartime experiences of World War II. Who am I? My name is Dennis Tidswell. I live in Pembroke. I'm now 98 and a half years old, and unfortunately, that wonderful human faculty of memory does begin to fade, so before it goes completely, I will make every endeavor to talk about those experiences, something that I haven't done before. I think to appreciate my feelings during the wartime of my experiences, it would help a little to go back to my childhood days to know what you're dealing with. I was brought up in a small village called Gindros, which is about 3.5 miles outside of Swansea. My father was a member of the Swansea Police Force. He, during the First World War, was in the Grenadier Guards and rose through the ranks, and at the end of that war was granted a commission. Now, he always told me that in the forces, if you wanted a commission, you needed a private income, which was something I didn't have when I came to the point of becoming a member of the forces. But during my young days, society in Forest Foch, and indeed the whole of Wales, was passing through a very deeply religious fervour. There were indeed two factions of society. There were the deeply religious, and then there were the otherwise non-believers who led a very different kind of life. But my life was church three times on a Sunday, and the whole area was literally covered in Welsh chapels with names like Calvary and Bethany, Zion, Sharon, Jerusalem, Hebron. Then there was a one established church, which I think was called the Church in England in those days. Church in Wales hadn't appeared on the scene. And then there were the other denominations of the Gospel Hall, the Baptists, Jehovah's Witnesses, Salvation Army, and the Congregational. And it was to the Congregational Church that I was sent three times every Sunday. So here we had this young lad brought up very strictly in a very religious atmosphere. I have vivid recollections of being taken to the largest Welsh chapel called Calvary in nearby Forest Foch. I stood, I suppose, about almost 3 feet tall, at 7 or 8 years of age, amongst a congregation of probably best part of 400 or more people, giving full voice to Bread of Heaven, which literally lifted the roof, and to me was almost a terrifying experience. This tremendous noise. But, however, that's just an aside. The other faction of society, of course, were the pub goers and the billiard halls and the club goers. Wales was dry in those days. There were no drinks on a Sunday in pubs, but you could get a drink in a club. But there were two very distinct factions of society. I can't say I had a particularly good education. I wasn't able to take the 11 plus. I had, as a young man, a nervous facial tic, which set me back a bit in that my parents took me everywhere to try and cure this. I have distinct memories of being taken to someone called a phrenologist, who made an analysis of what may be wrong with you by the bumps in your head. Anyway, by the time I'd come round to about 14 years of age, that tick unfortunately disappeared, and my interests mainly were swimming, cycling, tennis, and amateur dramatics. But when the war broke out in 1939, I soon found myself somewhat on my own, because a lot of my friends who were slightly older had joined the forces in one way or another. And I was now an insurance clerk with a company called the London Assurance. I had made up for my poor education by evening studies and getting various certificates for mathematics and accountancy, and I was studying insurance examinations. My favourite hobbies were photography and radio. My father was a keen radio amateur, and in the early 30s we were just coming out of the crystal set and moving into wireless sets made with thermionic valves. So he had taught me how to build a wireless set. So one day I took it into my head that I would like to join the Royal Air Force. Another one of my hobbies was aero modelling and flying model aeroplanes. So one particular morning I go to the RAF recruiting office at the bottom of Page Street in Swansea, and sat in front of this group of these RAF officers. What age are you, my boy? I'm 17. Well, come back when you're 18. Another. As I passed the sergeant at the door at the entranceway, he said, you're 18 next week, aren't you, boy? I said, no, it's next July. You're 18 next week, aren't you, boy? So I got the message, and I came 2 or 3 weeks later. I found myself sitting in front of this group of RAF officers at the recruitment centre. They go into your educational background. then ask about your pastimes and hobbies. I mean, when I mentioned that I was interested in wireless and could build a wireless set, they cottoned on to that one and talked very much about that. But I wanted to train very much as a pilot. That was the whole object in going and joining the Air Force, to learn to fly and to be a pilot. But they said that why wouldn't I join now as a radio operator, and then at some later date I could quite easily remuster and train as a pilot. But things didn't quite turn out that way. A radio operator had nothing to do with flying at all, I discovered. It was really very high frequency intercommunication between ground and aircraft. So, which was rather different to what I intended, but I went along with that, and in a matter of a couple of months, really, I was called up. Apparently, they were very short of radio operators at that particular time. So here we had this somewhat naive young man leaving home for the very first time to go out into the big wide world. My mother cried. My father said, well, that'll make a man out of him. And off I went and started at Uxbridge, which was a recruiting centre, and then on to Padgate, insofar as, in terms of language, I seldom have ever heard the F word. That was certainly not part of the vocabulary. In July 1940, I turn up at the recruiting centre at Uxbridge, amongst quite a few others, hundreds of people, where we were put into groups of about 50, and we were sworn in. And here you agree to to obey orders and keep to the King's regulations, though no one had ever read them. And of course, an allegiance to the sovereign. And once you had sworn this oath, you were no longer a civilian, you were now a member of HM Forces. And indeed, this was a defining moment which put you firmly in your place. I was now an aircraftsman second class. The bottom of the pecking order. We were then directed to some tents which were on grassland between some rather nice looking brick buildings, but they were not to be our sleeping place. We were showed where we were to sleep, and that was in a tent on a straw palliasse, which was damp and musty and smelly, with one blanket and a sausage, or a canvas bag, I suppose about 9-inch diameter, and that was your pillow, and that was where you were to sleep, and henceforth you were to wash and shave in cold water. Now, this indeed was the second part of the culture shock. However, that was only to last about 4 or 5 days, and we were then put into a billet, as it was called, which was like a Nissen hut with a cast iron pipe stove. But fortunately, it was July, so there was a reasonable temperature, and it contained a number of steel bed frames with the wire springs across, and three were called biscuits. They were the mattress you slept on, divided into three sections, and two blankets, rather coarse things, made you scratch an itch, and the sausage as a pillow, and that was your sleeping quarter. There was a corporal's room at the end, and the corporal was invariably a regular airman, and a charming sort of chap, because he would wake you up in the morning very politely. Come on, you suds, wakey wakey, get your hands up your cocks and get moving, and stand by your beds at 8 o'clock. Very friendly sort of, you know, got a greeting, but anyway, when you stood by your bed, you'd been taught how to stand to attention for the orderly officer, who came round, looked you up and down, and from bed to bed, I found this business of being stood to attention not very much to my liking. You were usually commanded to stand to attention in the presence of an officer, and the command of stand to attention is being like placed in an invisible straitjacket, with your arms bound to your sides, and your legs immobilized, and your brain literally numbed by the aura of class distinction. I found this was an ultimate humiliation, and I felt degradation. Now they put you in your place, and at their mercy, move or twitch an eyebrow at your peril. However, there was now no going back. I had sworn allegiance to a sovereign, one I had never met or ever likely to, yet under whom I was prepared to sacrifice the one life I had. So it behoved me now, I felt, to accept my surroundings, and I volunteered for it, so just get on with it. And I think that was the right move, because otherwise life could have been very miserable indeed. But anyway, at Uxbridge, you then came to being kitted out. Kitting out. You're saying farewell to your civilian clothes, and you're now about to don a uniform. In this great big hall, loads of tables and piles of clothes, you walk up to the counter, height, 5'2", and can fly at you a tunic, before that you've been given a white kit bag, stood about 3 foot high, about a foot in diameter, and for the time being you simply put all this uniform into this kit bag. So it came flying at you at the rate of knots, length of inside leg, 27, okay, and all this clothing, shirt, vest, pants, came hurling at you, and then the one final thing, a pair of boots. Now, I'd never worn boots in my life, but I was about to learn what it was like, because at Uxbridge, you were taken out on to the parade ground by the drill sergeant, who was another very polite gentleman. I won't repeat a lot of the way he described us, but anyway, marching back up and down the boots were chafing my ankles, so I red raw legs around my ankles, and you were given a rifle. Now, what a rifle had to do with the RAF, I don't know, but of course you had to learn the appropriate drill. So we were given a Lee Enfield rifle, no bullets, and all the cleaning kit and the gear, and trained how to use it in marching and on parade. And when I turned came to do a guard duty at night, you present yourself at the guard room, and they tell you you take your sentry post at the station entrance, and obviously you challenge any oncomer who goes there. And so I said, well, where are the bullets? The sergeant said, give you out bullets. So you were guarding the place, but you didn't have any bullets, but never mind. All that stage passed, and eventually they knocked us into shape, and we were able, I think, to march reasonably well. Before we leave Uxbridge, there's a couple of other recollections popped up. I'm not really sure whether I should include them, because things have got to be so politically correct in this year 2021. But way back in 1940, I think I should really tell it like it was, and in no way dress it up, but we were all lined up for ATT inoculation, anti-tetanus and typhoid. There stood two men in white coats. I presume one was a doctor, I don't know. And on this high table were three kidney-shaped white enamel dishes with a blue rim around the top. And they were filled with methylated spirits, and there were two rather large needles, the actual needle of which was not like the fine one that there is nowadays. It was really like a very fine nail, really. Anyway, there's hundreds of blokes lined up. There's two people. You came along, got it jabbed into your arm, and then that particular needle was thrown into the dish of mess where the other man rinsed it out and refilled it, and in sequence. So those two needles really injected hundreds of men. That was the ATT inoculation. And then one day we were all marched up to this large room and all seated down in front of a screen, cinema fashion, and we were shown a film about venereal disease. We're looking at ages 18 to 25-ish, the likes of me, who'd never had any sexual education at all, either school, college, home, anywhere. This film showed the in graphic detail the horrors of gonorrhea, and in the end it showed this chappy as rather like a violent epileptic fit who was in the advanced stages of syphilitic locomotor ataxia. But at least this had served the purpose. Put us off sex for quite a while, but at least it had taught most of us something of which we had precious little knowledge before. And then to round this off, the real classic was the FFI parade. Now, I had no idea what an FFI parade was, but we soon found out you stood in a long line, ordered to drop your trousers and roll up your shirt and expose your genitals. I thought, then we realized we're free from infection inspection. Wonder if it's a lady doctor, but then there weren't many lady doctors in those days, and if it had been the sight of all those hundreds of willies, it would have given her a nervous breakdown. But anyway, along comes this doctor, I presume, medical officer, and he's carrying like a musical conductor's baton. Every now and again he sticks it under someone's willy and makes a bit of a closer examination. And so it went on. So that was the the point at which I think I should end my description of Uxbridge, and then move on to the next posting, which was Padgate. I think I should explain at this point. I'm taking my dictation from recollections from my RAF record sheet, which I obtained from the RAF in records office in Gloucester way back in March 98. And things are getting a little bit hazy here. I'll read you the letter. Thank you for your letter dated February 98. I'm sorry to have to tell you that at this late date only a very brief record of your service in the Royal Air Force is now held at the RAF Headquarters Personnel and Training Command. This record was compiled at the time of your service and contains very little detail of your postings and movements at that time. However, I have enclosed a photograph of your service taken from the remaining record, which I hope will be of interest to you. Now, here in the record, after Padgate, there is a gap, and it says number one wing Sing 6RC, which I take to be a recruiting center. And the next posting in September 40 is to the RAF station at Tuxford. And I have some recollections of that. But between leaving Padgate and arriving at Tuxford, we must have acquired the necessary skills to operate this VHF radio system, because Tuxford was the operational headquarters at that time, I think, of number 12 group, and I have a recollection of looking up and seeing the odd dogfight, and of course Tuxford played a very active part in the Battle of Britain. But be that as it may, I only stayed at Tuxford for something like a month thereabouts, and then I got posted in October 40 to the RAF Signal School at Cranwell in Lincolnshire. Now, Cranwell in Lincolnshire was the RAF training college, and I learned another aspect of radio operating which did interest me very much, and that was called VHF-DF, very high frequency direction finding. And it was a means of radio communication which enabled us to establish the position for our own aircraft, radar being very much in its infancy at that stage. So Fighter Command in particular relied on VHF-DF, which consisted of three units, something like 40 or so miles apart, from which you drew a line on a bearing taken on their equipment and formed what was known as a cocked hat, and in that cocked hat was the position of our own aircraft. Radio transmission on VHF at ground levels was optical, but air to ground and ground to air was very clear reception. And sitting, listening out, which we had to do for very long periods at a time, was just listening to a quiet sort of mush, like a pshhh. The equipment was set up in wooden towers. And the beauty of all this was those towers were generally well away from any Air Force establishment. It was a little unit on its own, and most times the RAF personnel operated were in civilian billets. So to be away from RAF military discipline and operating in one of these units appealed to me very much. So I set my stall out for that at Cranwell, and over a period of, let me see, something like a month or 6 weeks, qualified as a VHF DF operator. I was then sent to a station in Curtin and Lindsay in Lincolnshire. That was in November 1940. Now, all this time, I was still radio operator on the ground when really I joined this outfit to learn to fly and to be a member of air crew. And I have a recollection of going to Cardington and sitting in front of this panel of RAF officers. Now, according to my records, that took place in May 1941. This was a selection board for air crew. And I see, according to my record, it reads, accepted for training as pilot, observer, wireless OPG, 8th to the 5th, 1941. So from that date onward, I was waiting to go for air crew training. But then, out of the blue, at Curtin and Lindsay, along comes a sergeant and says, report to so-and-so, and you're being posted abroad. Well, now, I can't go abroad, I'm waiting for air crew training. You're being posted abroad. I said, well, can I have an interview with the commanding officer? You are being posted abroad. So I thought, well, to hell with this. So I took it into my head to go straight up to the commanding officer's office, leading Air Corpsman Tidwell, goes into the station commander's office, and said, I want to see the commander. Whereupon I was pounced upon by two sergeants, took me by one arm either side, knocked my cap off, and frog marched me backwards out of the office. And then I found myself on a charge for insubordination. So the following day, I appeared in front of the station commander and offered my apologies and said, but I was listed for aircrew training. Why was I being sent abroad? He said, we too have to do as we are told. You, I understand, are a radio DF operator, and they, wherever you're going, they seem to be urgently needed. So I'm sorry, but you are going abroad. And were it not for that fact, you would be on a very serious charge. And now you would be spending your time in the glasshouse, which was the RAF term for being in prison. But anyway, be that as it may, the next thing, I was kitted out for foreign service, khaki shirt, ordinary vest, tin hat, respirator, and now a backpack, a blanket, and a ground sheet. So you rolled your ground sheet around a blanket like a long sausage, and then you strapped it in the form of three parts of a square on the back, around your backpack. It rather looked like a bit like a French legionnaire. But we didn't have that neck protector like the Frenchman had, but a very similar in appearance. And of course, all this had to be packed in this extra backpack. And by now, the load to carry about was the winter gear. But there was one bright spot about all this. You no longer wore boots abroad. You had shoes. The other ranks had leather shoes. Officers had hush puppies and cotton socks, whereas ranks had thick woolen socks. And hush puppies, which we nicknamed brothel creepers. And the trouble with the woolen sock abroad, I'll come to later, but I found myself boarding a train for Greenock, way up north. And on the train we were really like sardines in a tin. Packed. It was quite an unpleasant journey, really. But anyway, at Greenock, or Greenock, we then went aboard various ships. At Greenock, some 1,750 personnel, mainly army, and probably about a third of that Royal Air Force, we boarded a ship called the Leinster. The Leinster was a British and Irish ferry boat that in normal times crossed the Irish Sea on a daily basis. And she'd been taken over by the Department of Transport. She wasn't a very, in fact, she turned out to be the smallest of the convoy in which we found ourselves. She just weighed 4,300 tons, where the larger merchant ship was almost 11,000 tons. For the historian, this it was called Operation Substance, that is in July 1941. The naval coverage was quite extensive. The Nelson, the Manxman, the Edinburgh, Manchester, Arethusa, and something like seven other destroyers. Now, none of us were aware at that time where we were bound, but when we got aboard, we were asked if we would form watches. The watch was to be placed at intervals all around the ship, and on any sightings they were to pass voice-wise back to the bridge. The accommodation, I can't really remember much about the food, but what does strike me, I remember quite a bit. Takeover. Where were we? Back on the Leinster. Well, the Leinster, there were 1,700 troops aboard, a mixture of Army and Air Force. Air Force about 300 or so, I would say. I can't remember much about the food. Sleeping accommodation, we slept in hammocks. They were all slung between all the various loads of pipes that there are on ships. And one would look and see all these line of hammocks swinging away. Now a hammock is a bit tricky to get into on land, but on a rolling ship it tends to be a bit tricky. And the Leinster did roll. She didn't have any stabilizers. And we were at this time forming and maneuvering into a convoy. The convoy, for the benefit of the historian, was to be known as Operation Substance in July 1941. There were some seven odd merchantmen, and quite a number of naval vessels. The naval vessels were the Nelson, the Manxman, the Edinburgh, the Manchester, the Arethusa, and something like seven destroyers. This operation I learned after actually when I looked up the record was to relieve Malta. Malta being under siege at that time and was desperately in need of practically everything. The powers that be, I said, somehow or another, this convoy must get through. However, we're back on the Leinster. We set sail in a westerly direction for probably half a day, and then we turned south, and I suppose after about 36 or so hours, we were told to change into our tropical gear, which we did, of course. During this time, one of our radio operator crew, a man called Dick Watson, who was a coloured gentleman from Jamaica, who had come over to the UK at his own expense and just to join the Royal Air Force. I had a great respect for him, but he had fallen somehow and injured his ankle. So in the ship's medical quarters, they'd put on a light plaster. He could just hobble around. So he needed to be assisted in and around, getting in and out of his hammock, etc. However, we are now in our tropical gear, an enormous number of white knees, and we're heading south. And then we find we're into the Straits of Gibraltar, and we arrive at Gibraltar. We were given shore leave, strangely enough, and I have recollections of going to a pub in Bell Lane in Gibraltar, there was beer available in those days, and we all got a bit merry and went back aboard and got into our bunks and fell asleep. But the next thing we know, after probably about 5 or 6 hours, the engine started up and we were underway. And quite clearly, we were moving on for the rest of our voyage. But all of a sudden, there was one enormous bang, and the ship shook and didn't completely turn on its side, but it turned over at a bit of an angle. If I remember rightly, it leaned onto the port side, I think it was. But there again, 80 years ago, it's a bit vague on detail like that, but we were down below, a couple of decks down, and and we found ourselves in almost complete darkness, a couple of chinks of light coming through, but the gangways and the stairways were just at a bit of an angle, and obviously in the almost dark. This was a rather frightening situation, that you were trapped down below, and certainly no easy access to the upper deck. We also had Dick Watson with his injured ankle. Anyway, we could hear a lot of noise and banging and bumping up on the main deck. But when we eventually did get through into daylight, the whole place really was pandemonium, really. I got onto the to the port side because it didn't seem possible to launch lifeboats on the starboard side, but I'd never heard an order to abandon ship, but that's clearly what was being done, because when I got down to the ship's rail, there were 7 lifeboats, 6 of them absolutely chock-a-bang full, and the 7th pretty well full. And so they had got Dick Watson aboard the lifeboat, and from the ship's rail, I then jumped into the stern part of the last lifeboat. There's a distance of about 6 or 7 feet, and you go down with a bit of a bump. But anyway, I'm in the stern end of the 7th tightly packed lifeboat. Now, it's clearly, there was a mist just lifting, and I could see on the mainland a pillarbox type of thing with these soldiers, and clearly the reason for the evacuation was that no one wanted to be detained in Spain. Mr. Franco was very friendly with Mr. Hitler, and to be his guest for the remainder of the war didn't appeal at all. But anyway, the lifeboats were all put in a line and connected by a line, and the one lifeboat had an engine. And about 3/4 of a mile out in the, in the bay at sea was a naval craft. I think it was a destroyer, but I'm not sure. But I chug out to the destroyer, who then put us in tow. And when he got underway, of course, all the lifeboats' bows lifted up. And anyway, next thing we know, out of the mist comes the Rock of Gibraltar. And I had my pocket camera in my pocket, and to this day, I've got some photographs that I took from the lifeboat of the Rock of Gibraltar. When we got to Gibraltar, we were put aboard a ship called the Louis Pasteur, which is obviously of French origin, and she was a very, very different kettle of fish. We we were able to have a shower, a shower the like of which I'd never seen in my life or even heard of. Instead of the water flowing down from a shower head, it came from pipes on the side. I think it was called a needle shower, but the jet of water was horizontal from the side, from your feet right up to your head. And that indeed was very refreshing. Alongside it was the French idea of a gent's toilet, because it was a long, wide, 2 foot wide plank of wood, about 20, 25 feet long, and about every 5 feet a hole was cut, and that was where you did your ablutions. You just sat down, had a chat. The flushing system was quite unique. There was something like a 8-inch pipe at one end, which was constantly flowing a strong flow of water. So there was a thorough flushing 24 hours a day. I can't remember much about the food. I can remember going down, way down below into the engine room and meeting Scottish engineers who, to my astonishment, were drinking gin. I was introduced to gin. I never tasted as much gin in my life until I met these chaps. But anyway, I think I've probably transmitted enough for this time, so we'll leave it there and we'll come back to the moment when I'm aboard the Louis Pasteur in the harbour at Gibraltar. We are now in Gibraltar, and I think at this stage, assuming the situation in the Mediterranean might well be appropriate. The Med being a completely landlocked sea, we are in Gibraltar, but to the north there is Spain, France, Italy, Greece, islands of Corfu and Crete, all occupied by hostile forces. Also North Africa, under the control of Rommel. So the only British place, of course, was Malta and Gozo. So quite clearly, if you're travelling east, that is your obvious destination. We weren't officially told that, but that was a general buzz amongst the troops. So from the Louis Pasteur, we were transferred to a warship called the Hermione. And the Hermione was a modern fast cruiser of the Dido class. Unfortunately, she had a very short lifetime, because she was commissioned in March 1941 and sank in June 1942. She was torpedoed and with a loss of about 700 lives. But she was actually a very fast ship. Its speed was 32 knots. Its range was 1,500 miles. And its armament was state-of-the-art for the day. It was absolutely bristling with with various guns of all sorts. And it also had torpedo tubes. At this time, Malta was under siege, undergoing very heavy bombing. I think I'll just read a very short paragraph written by an historian. Defense against such attacks and against the regular air raids were a constant drain on ammunition. Moreover, the 1,750 troops and RAF support personnel now in Gibraltar, as a result of the grounding of the Leinster, were not only urgently required on Malta, but an embarrassment where they were. To maintain stocks of munitions between major convoys and to push through the stranded soldiers and airmen, Operation Style was run from the west. The designated ships sailing from Gibraltar were Arethusa, Hermione, and the Manxman, each of which embarked her quota of passengers and cases of aviation spirit, ammunition, foodstuffs. Manxman's mine decks were capacious compared with the available spaces on the two cruisers, where every water closet and bathroom were stacked with cases, drums, cartons of food. Now, when we went aboard the Hermione, the skipper piped up and welcomed us aboard, and said, "Well, now on passage, I can feed you, but I've got problems with water. I can only allocate you a pint per person per day, and that is that. We slept against the sides of the ship's hull. As we were, you did not dress, you just slept where you could. Kept your tin hat and respirator handy, and I didn't realize it at that particular moment, but I suppose I was about to receive what you might call my baptism of fire, and realize the real horrors of war. On board the Hermione, as with the convoy, you could volunteer for duties, and having the experience of being down below when the ship ran aground in Algeciras Bay, I didn't fancy the idea of bombing and torpedo raids when I was down below, so I volunteered to work on deck, and I found myself passing boxes of ammunition to the crew gunners of the pom-pom guns. And I suppose we were about 2 days out, something like that, the ship was traveling quite fast. When a ship of some 7,000 odd tons is going along at 32 miles an hour, you know you're moving. But suddenly the klaxon goes, action stations. I hadn't really had time to get up on deck before the piped up, "Stand by to ram, stand by to ram." and there was a terrific crash. The ship shuddered from stem to stern, and carried on sailing. It turned out we had rammed an Italian submarine called the Tambien, which was charging its batteries at dawn on the surface. And the following ships in our wake felt the contact of the sub underneath their hulls. And the Hermione sustained a gash in its bow. But I suddenly realized what a terrible way to die in a submarine, being rammed by another ship. And that's what I mean when I say the horrors of war became apparent to me. Well, a couple of days into the passage, and we were finding it rather hot in that we weren't very long from the UK and had no time to acclimatise, and the Med in July was hot, and below decks we hadn't changed our clothing. We stayed and even taken our clothes off for a couple of days, and we were like sardines in a tin, and rather uncomfortable. But anyway, we must be now approaching the real hot spots of the passage. We were coming up to the Sicilian Straits and the Narrows. And of course in Sicily we now had the Luftwaffe and the Italian Aeronautica. The Italians did their bombing from high level, but were very accurate really. And the Germans had their Ju-88s and their Stukas. And we were coming to well within their range. And then I had volunteered, of course, to assist in passing the ammunition boxes to the pom-pom guns on the deck. And the klaxon sounded, action stations, and now was my real baptism of fire, because we came under attack, air attack mainly, bombs flying all round, fortunately missing the ship. The ship, I think, must have been doing a sort of zigzag course, because the deck never stayed still. The angle seemed to alter all the time, and the noise was absolutely terrific. The engine noise, the ship was doing its full 32 knots, the exploding shells, bombs, anti-aircraft, it was absolute pandemonium. To comment on my feelings at that time, first of all, when it all started, is one of fright. Certainly one of fright. And then suddenly it becomes one of excitement. And then suddenly one of aggression. Because you realize, well, it's either him or it's me. And this wasn't a fun game. You're either going to live or you're going to die. So you had to make every endeavor to survive. And that is a feeling I should probably never have again, never particularly want to, but it's quite an experience, really. But anyway, we survived that unscathed, and eventually, not very long actually afterwards, sailed into Malta Harbour and tied up. And I think that'd be sufficient for this episode.